Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Thanks for joining us. This is a special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics, hosted at Big Grove in Iowa City. I'm Emily Woodbury.
And I'm Erin Jordan. Tonight we wanted to introduce our panelists. We've got on the far end there Adam Sullivan, Gazette columnist. Linda Waddington, Gazette columnist. Todd Dorman, editorial and insights editor at the Gazette.
And former Iowa State representative from Waterloo, who served for 14 years, Deborah Barry. Now, Deborah, you have more than 25 years of experience in media, public relations, nonprofit management, corporate and government policy, and last July you were appointed as president and executive director of KBBG Radio in Waterloo. We're going to be talking to you about your career. I want to start off by, asking you, you were the first Black woman to represent Waterloo and one of the first Black women in the Iowa House of Representatives. Tell us what that experience was like.
Well, first of all, let me thank you for this opportunity, the Gazette, Iowa Public Radio, and all of you here tonight. Being the first African American from Waterloo to serve in the Iowa House of Representatives has been a wonderful experience. As it was mentioned that I served for 14 years, so I one day just decided enough is enough, and so I consider myself a recovering politician. So, with that being said, it was very serious work. It was, I've always had a passion throughout all my life just to really try to make a difference and help the least of these, And when the opportunity opened, before I ran in 2002, I was sitting on the Waterloo City Council. So I had a couple years of government experience as a one-term, two-year city councilwoman. So it prepared me, I thought, for the Iowa House of Representatives. But I'm doing now what I truly love, my passion, and that is radio, media, those kinds of things. So,
I wanted to follow up too. You represented Waterloo, a city with the highest percentage of African Americans in the state. What was it like to be representing the city of Waterloo in a state that is mostly white? I mean, did you feel like, what was that like?
Well, it's really interesting that you would ask that question. It was not really not normal because I was born and raised in that district in the state of Iowa, and so, Iowa was my home, so I was accustomed to Iowa. But as I grew up and, began to realize a lot of the disproportionate kinds of areas, like in, education and disproportionate numbers in the criminal justice system, that's when I realized, wait a minute, we've got a little bit of a problem here, which was another reason that, another thing that encouraged me to run for office and try to make a difference in those areas. But for the most part, I don't want to just sound like this is a cliche, but some of my best friends are white, that kind of thing. But because that's where we grew up in Iowa. And you don't begin to appreciate and value just the differences in people until you leave Iowa and go somewhere else. And then you say, I can't wait to get back home. Because we just carry a very special work ethic, a very special genuineness that you can't find anywhere.
So. You call yourself a recovering politician. What are some of the lessons and takeaways that you bring from your years in the Iowa legislature?
Lessons I've learned pretty much that everyone that's serving in the Iowa House, they're all there to do their best to make a difference in the state, to make Iowa a better place. It's just that we have different ways of getting there. And that's where the the discussions and the debates come from is that I want to get there this way, you have another way to get there. So, but the key is to be able to listen and hear what your neighbor's saying, your colleague is saying, and then really work to pull the best out of what everyone has said, and then try to work toward it. Now, in my opinion, in terms of what we see today, you don't have those conversations anymore. You're not seeing where, you know, whatever, you know, Todd might think, it's like, I don't care what you think, we're gonna do it this way because I'm in the majority party, kind of a thing. And that's what's unfortunate about politics today. So I think it's important that we, you know, try to get back to those good old days when I remember, me being there, again, 14 years, my first couple terms, we, Democrats and Republicans, we went out for dinner together, we, you know, went to movies and did wonderful activities together to better understand each other as different individuals. And but now I don't think you have that. And I think that's what's unfortunate. And I wish we could get back to that.
So thinking about your position now as president of KPPG, which is, I read, is the longest or the oldest African-American owned and operated radio station in the state.
That's right.
What are some of your goals for the station?
Well, what I want to see happen at the radio station, I carry the same philosophy as a legislator. I really want to make that radio station better than it was. Again, it's a 40-year-old radio station founded by a wonderful man in the 70s, Jimmy Porter, where it was a time of right after the Civil Rights Movement when a lot of different minority radio stations were birthed. But I think what I want to see happen, it's a whole new day from that time. And now the station has been a bit stagnant and stuck there, where now we have got to move into the 21st century. We have got to reach these little stubborn millenniums. We've got to reach you guys a little bit and do whatever it is to, you know, share and help them to understand the importance of community radio, public radio, and giving and supporting and things like that. You know, we're up against all kinds of entities, internet radio, satellite radio, Sirius, XM, Spotify, you know, all those different competitions we face. So what I'm trying to do is incorporate some of those things, yet keeping with the localism of public radio.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. I'm joined by my co-host,
Erin Jordan,
investigative reporter with the Gazette. And we are in a Pints and Politics discussion at Big Grove in Iowa City. Our columnists, Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, and Adam Sullivan of the Gazette. And now Deborah Berry, former state representative from Waterloo, will join us for our political discussion. We're going to dig into everything that's been happening over the last few weeks. A lot of it's happened over the last few days, though. I know some of you may remember when we did Pints in Politics originally, we would go back months to things that happened months ago, and now it looks like we should probably check our phones and make sure nothing's happened in the last few minutes. First, to start us off, let's talk about the big news, North Korea. President Trump announced today that he'll meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un June 12th in Singapore. And this will be the first ever meeting between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader. What got us to this point? Adam, you want to start us off?
Sure. I think, certainly U.S. foreign policy in a soft way has changed. And now when people talk about soft power, they talk about kind of these, soft issues where, you know, the United States standing in the world, kind of rhetorical things. When Donald Trump took office, that really changed. And it really shook up the way that Asian nations are aligned with each other. They had, because the United States has been such a strong presence in that region, that all kind of got shook up once Donald Trump signaled that he would kind of rein in some U.S. influence around the world. And so really, you know, South Korea and North Korea, I think, felt forced to work together. They felt like they were in a volatile situation. You saw just last week, Representative Steve King put forth Donald Trump to win a Nobel Peace Prize based on the idea that he facilitated the North-South peace process. It is a ridiculous idea, but it was also ridiculous when Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize. So I think a little bit, it was a jab at that a little bit.
You know, I'm not going to talk about Steve King. But you know, I think we should all be very thankful that we have three Americans back in our nation. Arriving this morning at St. Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington, D.C. So whatever's happening right now, let's be thankful for that. And let's hope and pray that when this meeting comes, that it leads to good things.
Yeah, and if, you know, if it leads to good things, obviously, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of corollaries. I mean, North Korea has done charm offensives before and talked about denuclearization and rejoining with the South, and things didn't happen. You know, Donald Trump's allies will say that his sort of bluster and belligerence pushed North Korea to the table. There's others that say, well, maybe North Korea just saw this as a chance to sort of score some points and maybe get some sanctions lifted for making promises that they don't intend to keep. I mean, I hope there is denuclearization. If Donald Trump gets that done, then good for him, but because the world would be safer. I'm just skeptical that North Korea is going to give up nuclear weapons, which is basically the only thing that keeps that regime protected. And so I'd be surprised if they do, but we'll see what happens on the 12th.
Moving from one country that we have tense relations with to another, wanted to ask about Iran. So this week, President Trump pulled America out of the Iran nuclear deal, which was signed in 2015. Do you think that with his tough talk with Iran, do you think that this is him, you know, talking tough at first and then he'll back down? Or what do you expect is going to happen?
Well, let me just say first that it was an absolutely horrible decision that America entered into an agreement with allies, and now America has backed out of that agreement. There were opportunities to perhaps work out some different aspects to that agreement, and it didn't seem to be going his way, so we're just gonna pick up our toys and leave the sandbox. Or maybe take the whole damn sandbox, I don't know. I don't know that you can continue to negotiate when you've already shown your cards. And that's my biggest worry with Iran, and that we had missiles flying over Israel last night should be a big warning to everybody.
It's not a coincidence. I've said this before, but the fact that Trump has made more aggressive rhetoric towards Syria, the fact that he's making more aggressive rhetoric towards Iran and trying to pull us out of the Iran nuclear deal is specifically because John Bolton is part of this administration. John Bolton's stated position is that we need to overthrow the government of Iran. And now, I'm not that old, but I'm old enough to remember the Iraq War, and I know overthrowing a government in a Middle Eastern country is a really, really bad idea, and it's John Bolton's idea.
Well, and these sort of agreements they always have flaws. There's things in them that you don't want because you have to give something, they give something. I mean, that's how it works. The biggest problem with this is that, I mean, administrations change, presidents have different goals, but in this case, there's no plan B. We've gotten rid of this negotiated settlement, this treaty, and now what are we going to do? I mean, are we going to go to war with Iran? I mean, I don't know if we're prepared to do that. Is that the plan B? It doesn't seem like it. It seems like we do a good job of sort of sowing chaos in some of these regions and doing things that you know, maybe make us unpredictable, but what happens next? I mean, that's always the question.
I think we had the opportunity to go to a more moderate position, even pulling out of the agreement, but we didn't even do that. I mean, it was very clear from the beginning that we plan on publishing businesses in our ally countries. We plan on punishing our ally countries if anyone cooperates with Iran. And that's not a way to treat your friends.
Well, it's a campaign rally is not a great place to test your foreign policy themes. And I mean, that's the problem with this. He campaigned on getting rid of this deal. It's a horrible deal. It's the worst deal ever. But as I said, you know, what's next? I mean, we have to somehow deal with the nuclear threat of Iran. Now I think that this has made it more likely they're going to restart their program. And how do you stop it? Do you bomb it? I mean, what do you do? I mean, that's That's the problem. And as Adam said, I mean, we went to war in Iraq. We know how costly war is. I mean, that doesn't seem like a good option.
We wanted to talk a little bit, too, about kind of switching to NAFTA. President Trump is renegotiating NAFTA right now with Mexico and Canada. How important will it be to protect the agriculture industry from further tariffs or other impacts? What do you see happening on that front?
Well, I'll start. I don't see NAFTA as being important as other trade agreements in terms of agriculture. But I did see a report from the National Association of Manufacturers talking about the roughly 3,000 manufacturers we have here in Iowa, and about a third of those rely on exports to predominantly Canada, but also Mexico. And about 25,000 Iowa jobs are linked to those exports. So if we can't hash this out, that's basically what Iowa is putting on the table, is about 25,000 jobs. I know we also have union friends who have long been critical of this deal. I think what they would like to see is the rising of all ships, meaning that there were not worker protections built into the deal. So lower wages in Mexico, they feel, are driving down lower wages here in the United States. Hopefully that can get resolved, and that we can continue NAFTA, because no tariffs between Canada, Mexico, and the United States is a really good deal for Iowa.
I think the devil's always in the detail with this kind of thing, and the details that we're getting out of those negotiations are relatively sparse. We don't have a great idea of how things are coming together. But I would say that, big picture, the unfortunate thing is that we have a president, a Republican president, who believes in economic protectionism in a way that Republican presidents in my lifetime have not believed in. One thing kind of on the bright side of that, you know, myself being a capitalist free trade guy, is now we have a whole generation of Democrats who are against tariffs just because Donald Trump is for them. And so I hope we can keep that going for the rest, a couple more generations as well.
Well, and so much has changed since we first negotiated NAFTA. I mean, Canada and Mexico and other countries that we're, you know, entering sort of trade wars with, they can look to other places to trade. I mean, China is a much stronger economic power than it was when NAFTA was negotiated. The European Union is a much stronger market. So it's harder for us to bully, Mexico and Canada, because they can take their business elsewhere. And also, once again, as with Iran, The Trump administration doesn't seem to have a plan B. If this treaty falls apart, what do we do next? We simply don't know. And the negotiations haven't really pointed us in any specific direction.
Let's talk about the Russia probe. I don't think there's been a Pints in Politics this year that we haven't talked about it. The latest news, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani resigned from his law firm this week in order to concentrate on his legal work for the president. Now, based on the interviews he's been giving this week, what role do you see him playing in the special counsel investigation going forward?
I see him playing a very hilarious role. If I was Donald Trump, I would want him working at his law firm full time. I don't think he's doing any favors to the administration.
You go back and you look at the travel ban that Trump wanted to do. When they went in to attack that in court, they used Rudy Giuliani's words to put a halt on Trump's travel ban. Why he has now become part of the counsel for the president, I have no idea.
Maybe he'll become special permanent envoy to North Korea.
I think that's Dennis Rodman.
Yeah, he and Dennis Rodman, I think, would be an interesting combo.
So kind of looking at what we've got coming up, one of the things that's been happening this week is there's also been the CIA confirmation of Gina Haspel, the nominee for CIA director. Do you think her involvement in the post 9/11 interrogation techniques, some would consider torture, is that going to prevent her approval, or do you think that that's not really going to be too much of a stumbling block?
I think that's already been a major stumbling block. And to be clear, it is torture what she allowed to happen. She should not be the CIA director. But it's sad to see there's still a lot of Democrats who are, I mean, this is, should be a home run for them to come out swinging, say, this is a really bad Trump appointee. We're not going to stand for it. And the tally I saw today, I think there's only a handful of Senate Democrats who have said they're going to vote no, which is really disappointing. You've got one guy who knows more about torture than the other 99 senators combined. His name is John McCain. He's not going to be there to vote, but he's telling his colleagues, no, don't vote for Gina Haspel. So I think, you know, if you do care about these soft power issues, you know, the way that America looks on a rhetorical level, I think the worst thing in the world right now would be for Gina Haspel to direct our intelligence gathering.
All right, let's squeeze in one more topic before we take a short break. This Tuesday, we had voters in Ohio, West Virginia, Indiana, and North Carolina going to the polls. These are all states that Trump won in 2016. Do the election results from this week's primaries give any signal as to how the campaigns this year will go?
I'm just always very cautious of making those kind of judgments. I think things change a lot in the matter of a few months. All politics is local, as they say. And so, you know, the media, they've got to fill 24 hours a day, so they're going to say a lot about what this means for our upcoming elections. I don't think it necessarily means a lot for our upcoming elections.
So what's your takeaway, Adam? Do you take anything away, or are you just kind of waiting to see?
It seemed like it was kind of scattershot. You know, there was a few establishment people who won and a few establishment people who lost. And you also, you know, it's very selective with which races become hot kind of media commodities. So we're not necessarily getting the full picture of what's going on, I think.
And I think that people, you know, the memory span is so short with people nowadays, where you could have in your mind that, okay, I know what this, what's been going on is not, doesn't sit well with me, but then, and it can just change, as you were just saying, Adam, it's just, things change every day, so it's really hard to put a finger on it. So,
well, I found a little hope in the last election results, because it feels to me, based on those results, that maybe we're moving a little bit away from extremism. That, you know, Blankenship with his China persons, although I applaud his gender neutrality, I can't slide by his racism. So, you know, the fact that he came in third, however close a third it was still third, and he will not be on the ballot. Thank you, Jesus. And you may not want to clap yet, because also we have Dennis Kucinich, who was sent home, and thank you, Jesus, for that as well.
And I would say on Blankenship, if you make me feel like I'm on Mitch McConnell's side, then you've really got problems, because I'm not on his side very often.
You've been listening to Pints and Politics, a collaboration between the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Our conversation was recorded last night at Big Grove Brewery in Iowa City. I'm Emily Woodbury. My co-host this hour is Aaron Jordan, investigative reporter at the Gazette. And our panelists include Gazette columnist Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan. Former state lawmaker Deborah Berry of Waterloo joins the panel as well. We need to take a short break. We'll be back to talk state politics in a few minutes. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Good afternoon. You're listening to a special edition of River to River, Pints in Politics, a conversation recorded last night at Big Grove Brewery in Iowa City. I'm Emily Woodbury, and this hour I'm joined by my co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, and our analysts include Gazette columnist Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, and former state representative Deborah Berry of Waterloo. This weekend marks the 10-year anniversary of the Postville raid that led to hundreds of immigrants being prosecuted and later deported. And this week we also heard news of a raid by Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Mount Pleasant. Let's jump into our conversation from yesterday evening. Here are some responses from our panelists comparing these two raids and the immigration policies that led to them.
So for those of you who don't know, I actually covered Postville in the aftermath of the raid. I was actually at the Electric Park Ballroom for the makeshift courtroom and the trials that took place there. I have been having a rather emotional time with the raid that happened in Mount Pleasant, because it's kind of bringing back some of the memories, given that it's connected to the Postville 10-year anniversary. And actually, my Saturday column talks a little bit about this. I think we are returning to that previous time where we thought raids and deportations and criminal charges, only for the workers, by the way, was the way to go. And that's just not how we can run our country. We really have to get on board and do some comprehensive immigration reforms. And let's figure out what that looks like, but we've got to start talking. And, you know, I saw a report today from House Speaker Paul Ryan saying he wasn't going to bring anything to the floor that wasn't already agreeable to the president. We have got to start having discussions. And whether Donald Trump wants to be a part of that or doesn't want to be a part of that, you know, how you get a bill 2 years from now is to start the discussions now. Or how you get a bill 4 years from now is to start the discussions now. And we have completely backburned this issue. And it's costing us as a country, it's costing us economically, and it's costing our humanity.
And it's costing the... And it's costing just human dignity to me, where people... When I heard about that story and seeing that these folks are coming from as far away as Guatemala for a better life, you know, I think we're going heading in the wrong direction. And me being a minority, you know, it frightens me that, you know, who's to say some, you know, things won't occur within my own family. I mean, already we see excessive, you know, law enforcement doing some things, and, you know, just some, but, you know, we're concerned in my community that, you know, because, you know, people see you differently based on just your skin color, that, you know, you're dangerous, you know, you're a threat, and those kinds of things. So, you know, I also want to just take it a step further regarding, you know, the immigrants that come here. Somebody's hiring them. Who's hiring them? Somebody's saying, come and work for me. So I think we need to change that focus off them and go to the ones that are hiring them. That's what I think.
And how do you do that? Do you force employers to go through? I know there are systems that can tell whether an ID is real. Do you kind of put restrictions on businesses to make sure they're not hiring, or do you focus on the punitive aspect for employers?
I'm not sure about the specifics of it, but it's a question of law enforcement priorities, right? So you've got this segment of people that are obsessed with what they call the rule of law, that if anyone breaks any law ever, that, you know, you've got to come down with full force on them, even though we all break laws every day because there's too many damn laws. So this is a question of priorities, right? If you wanted to target employers, and if you wanted to target the people who incentivize illegal immigration, then you could do that. But again, I'm not even sure that that's the right approach. Maybe we don't need to penalize anyone. Maybe people can come here and work if they need to work, if they want to do jobs that aren't filled, because we've got a lot of unfilled jobs. And so it really does start with comprehensive immigration reform. To me, it's not an enforcement question. And I would say, you know, there's a lot of bad signs. There's a lot of signs, of anti-immigrant sentiment. But there are also a lot of pockets to the contrary, right? And so Dave Heaton, he's a Republican representative. He represents the plant where this took place. He voted against the sanctuary city bill, you know, 2-3 weeks ago before this all happened. And so even very conservative people, if they have immigrants in their communities, if they understand the social and the economic value that immigration has, they can be on our side on this issue.
And it's really simple. You know, the most segregated time in America is on Sunday mornings, when we all go to our own churches and we don't pretty much reach out and try to go to other churches and get to know people. That's a little disheartening for me, but yeah, it's really simple in my view. You just have to kind of come out of your comfort zone and try to get to know people, because I think we all have the same basic human needs and wants and desires, and we want our kids to live and thriving, you know, be safe, and taken care of and thriving communities and things like that. So I think when you have an administration that, you know, infuses fear and things like that, where else can we go but backward? There's no other direction.
I do think it's important to point out that Trump has said really bad things about immigrants. It looks like he's doing really bad things with ICE. But Barack Obama actually deported more people than his predecessor.
Yeah, he did.
And that's just to say that anti-immigrant sentiment for my whole lifetime has totally been bipartisan. And so it's not, Trump didn't start this. He's definitely ramped it up, but Trump didn't start this. This existed in America way before 2016.
So I've got another viewer question here, and there's a section that's in quotes, so I'm going to have to use some air quotes here. It says, the excellent mental health bill that was passed in the Iowa legislature this session doesn't seem to be funded. Am I right?
You're right. Next question.
Well, there's always a lot of unfunded mandates. That's the thing. People say, yay, we passed health reform, okay, but how do we now, where's the money to support it? So yeah, that's typical.
So is there really no plan for this?
I mean, you've got a state budget that's got lots of challenges, and one of the newest challenges is that we've passed a $2.1 billion tax cut. And that's gonna, I mean, as much as the spin that's going on is that, well, we're still gonna be able to increase the budget and cut taxes and give everybody cupcakes and whatever else, you know, we can do. It's going to cause budget stress even more than what we have, and things like mental health and education and public universities and all those things are going to continue to face tight budgets, perhaps even tighter than what we're seeing now. So yeah, I mean, it was a good bill. The mental health bill was a good bill. It did a lot of good things, or at least aspired to do a lot of good things. There just isn't funding to back it up, and the way it looks, the fiscal situation doesn't suggest there will be anytime soon.
So you mentioned the state tax cuts. The Iowa GOP passed what they call the largest state tax relief package in Iowa history. Who's set to benefit?
The analysis from the Department of Revenue says that of the total tax relief in the bill, about I think it's 11, maybe 12, 13% of it goes to folks that make $60,000 or less annually. And 46% of it, well, actually 46% of it goes to 2.5% of taxpayers who make over $250,000. It's almost half of it. And I think if you extend that down to $100,000, it's like 70% or more of the tax, of the benefit. So primarily, I mean, And conservatives will say, well, yeah, well, people who make more money pay most of the taxes, and that's true to some extent. But if you're going to pass tax relief, sometimes you might want to think about who actually needs it and who doesn't, and think of it in a progressive way. But this tax cut mainly provides relief to the top of the tax brackets and corporations, and it also raises taxes on Netflix. So,
yeah. Potentially. So the blockbusters are going to benefit. Finally, something for Blockbuster.
Yeah, yeah. It'll help Blockbuster. It'll it'll help taxi cabs, because we're gonna tax Uber now.
Finally.
So, yeah.
So I was disappointed with the bill because, so Republicans go on and on about how our tax rates are higher than almost every other state, and that's actually true. But the reason for that is we have all of these cutouts. We have all these tax credits and tax exemptions and deductions and stuff. So on, you know, the figure looks like it's really high, but after you factor that other stuff in, it's not. The tax bill calls for a comprehensive review of our state tax credits. And if you follow state government very closely, you mean that doesn't mean much at all. Right? So at some point, some legislature is going to have to get serious and have the courage to get rid of a lot of these tax deductions, or at least cap them, because some of these corporate tax credits, they're actually refundable. So these states, these companies don't have any tax burden. They actually get a check from the state, and that means all of our taxes are higher. And so even with this in place, our rates are still going to be in the top 25% among all states. So until they get serious about the tax cutouts, our tax system is going to be a total mess.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to a special edition of River to River, recorded Thursday night at Big Grove Brewery in Iowa City. I'm Emily Woodbury, and I'm here with my co-host Aaron Jordan, an investigative reporter at the Gazette. And joining us are columnists Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, and Adam Sullivan of the Gazette, as well as Deborah Berry, a former state representative from Waterloo. I want to get to another question from the audience. This audience member says that CAFOs, that's concentrated animal feeding operations, are overrunning Iowa and ruining water quality. What role will this issue play in the 2018 Iowa governor election?
I think it's an issue. If you live next to a CAFO, it's certainly an issue for you. If you live in a community where a lot of these have come on board in the last 10 or 15 years, it's certainly an issue. But a lot of our voters still live in urban areas. People in Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, and Des Moines don't have to interface with CAFOs at all. So I think it remains to be seen whether that's a big deal for the rank and file voters.
Todd, what do you think? You've written a lot about animal feeding operations as well.
Well, it's... You know, if it gets wrapped up into the broader issue about water quality, which seems to be important to some voters, I mean, I think that has a chance of resonating in the election. But, I mean, the issue is, and I think it has been for the better part of the last two decades, I mean, how much authority should local people have to sort of stop a confinement from being located where they live? And I think that, you know, one of the highest profile examples the last few years was in Allamaquee County, where there was a proposal to build a confinement near a trout stream in an environmentally sensitive area. And it was one of those situations where, because of the way the rules are written, this operation was going to raise just enough hogs that it fell beneath a lot of the permitting thresholds, a lot of the thresholds where you could maybe raise objections. And so that's what a lot of folks want to see changed. But, you know, we've had a legislature that isn't willing to even consider small changes to those regulations because large agricultural organizations don't want that to happen. So within that context, we could have a debate during the election about local control within the context of all of the other things that the legislature did regarding local control, you know, taking away their power to county's power to raise the minimum wage, outlaw plastic grocery sacks, which is apparently was a very big priority for somebody. So local control has been eroded. So that's another place where that CAFO issue could fit into an election debate.
You know, I haven't heard Democrats really talking about this issue either.
Well, it's one of those issues that's been, I mean, where I think we're going on our third generation now debating, you know, hog confinements and what they mean. And we've got the ratio of pigs to people is in Iowa.
7-1.
7-1. So, and pigs can't vote, so we have no idea how they'd weigh in. But.
And I think people think it's a rural issue is what I think.
Right, versus, and it's not necessarily.
No, it's not. Yeah. I mean, we're all affected by it, but that's what why I think that, you know, you can't get the feet on it to move it more because they think it's just relegated to rural areas.
So here, go ahead, Adam.
You mentioned, you know, Democrats aren't necessarily carrying this banner, and to a great extent that's true, but I mean, there's a reason that agriculture rules Iowa politics, and it's not just because Republicans are pro-corporation or whatever. It's because a lot of people are farmers, and a lot of people feel like their bottom line is connected to farming. Now, some people on the left will say, they'll make a case, like, we can do this in a profitable way, but as far as I've seen, they haven't convinced the majority of farmers that that's the case, and I think that's what it would depend on. Can you do sustainable farming in a profitable way on a statewide scale? Some people say you can, and I'm open to that possibility.
Well, and there's been a ongoing debate, you know, among farmers about, do the Farm Bureau and some of these large farm groups actually represent us, or are they representing sort of larger corporate entities that are, you know, doing a lot of the farming? So, I mean, that there's that debate too. So I think at some point we're going to reach a critical mass where they are going to reopen those livestock regulations, but it's going to take a different legislature. It's going to take some changes, but I think eventually that's a discussion the state's going to have.
So here's another question from the audience. It says, I am a U.S. Army vet with a carry permit for 40 years. I am uncomfortable going anywhere unarmed. Senator Joe Bolcom wants to criminalize carry in any business with a no weapons sign. What's your take?
First of all, thanks for your service. Second of all, If you want to carry, then carry on and don't do anything bad with your weapon. Third of all, if a business doesn't want you in their establishment with a weapon, I'm a staunch capitalist and I think you shouldn't be in their establishment with a weapon.
We're going to leave it there?
Yeah.
All right.
He's going to set it up.
I really like this one and this audience question. Maybe we can get to it briefly because we did promise Linda we'd get to the fetal heartbeat bill. This listener question says, please tell me one good thing about politics in Iowa this past year.
I know. I have something for you.
That I'm not there.
This year, the Iowa legislature ended school lunch shaming.
Yeah, that's true.
For those of you who don't know what that is, it's when the parents are remiss, there's not enough money in the school lunch account, and kids were either having their lunches dumped or were given the sandwich of shame. But in any event, it was making some children stand out as children who didn't have money for lunch. And we have ended this year. We haven't put any money into it. We've thrown that back on the school districts, but we've given them a lever where they can like recoup from state income taxes. So our kids will no longer be shamed, and to me that's a very great thing.
Deborah, it looked like you were gonna say something too.
Well, I just said the good thing about that happened this session is that I wasn't there that they carried on longer than normal. But I think really the good thing is that we're becoming more aware. You know, I think we're paying more attention, everyday people. And I think that's the good thing about what's happening right now in this climate, political climate. So keep on paying attention because we're gonna all need to be aware of what's ahead.
I would say the best thing in Iowa politics is that you can read me in the newspaper 3 times a week now.
I guess I have to weigh in since everyone else did. There was a leadership change in the Iowa Senate.
Oh, yeah.
So last week, Iowa lawmakers passed and the governor signed the strictest abortion ban in the nation. This is a law that would ban abortions past 6 weeks of pregnancy or after a fetal heartbeat is detected. And this is often before many women realize that they're pregnant. And I'll add that the law includes several exceptions, including in cases of rape, incest, and threats to the woman's health. What questions do you guys have about this law moving forward? What's top on your mind as you look at where this may go?
I mean, it's just the same old song, you know? It's just these emotional issues that get people angry and, oh gosh, it's just a distraction. I happen to just believe that it's a woman's choice. Let the woman decide. Let the doctor and her, and then, you know, on that day of judgment, then whatever's going to happen will happen. But I don't know. There's so many other things that we should be discussing and taking care of in terms of the business. So that's my take.
My understanding is that it will get challenged in court. It's likely to get thrown out in court. It's likely to cost the state a lot of money. I would say no matter where you're at on abortion, it should be clear that this bill is out of line with where the majority of folks are at in the country. And it's a waste of time, right? I mean, it's a good mailer for these guys to send to their donors, right? Send me another $100 because we did the heartbeat bill. But that's where it is. And I think these people know that it's not going to remain in code.
Linda, you're sitting back there.
I was going to let everyone else go first.
All right, well, now's the time.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
So if you all remember, last year we actually passed a 20-week abortion ban here in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually one of those folks, for those of you who don't know, that had a late-term abortion. And I had one because of fetal anomalies, meaning that my child would not survive. There were multiple neural tube defects, the worst of which was anencephaly, which is an absence of brain and skull. Absolutely a terminal condition. I approached my House member, my Senate member, other people in the legislature and said, please, if you're going to do this, allow an exception for fetal anomaly. It passed without one. However, the six-week abortion ban that was rushed through in the middle of the night has an exception for fetal anomaly. So someone needs to explain that disconnect to me. You know, my view is this was not done to help Iowa women. This was not done to protect life. This was done to challenge a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. And now, in addition to the grief that I've already gone through as a woman who went through all this, I'm expected to donate my tax dollars to the cause of the challenge of Roe v. Wade, which may not actually come because it may be taken up by the state Supreme Court. This is the most horrendous thing that I have ever in my lifetime seen a legislature do, and I will never forgive it.
You've been listening to Pints in Politics, a collaboration between the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. The panelists you've heard from include Gazette columnist Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, and former state representative Deborah Berry of Waterloo. My co-host is investigative reporter Aaron Jordan. This edition of River to River was produced and edited by Ben Stanton. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio.